Hello, everybody, to Talks Beyond Time and Place. My name is Philipp Röttgers, and it's been a long time since I've been online with this interview, series of interviews. And I'm very happy to be back today in 2024 with a very special guest. My guest today is Toby Virgo, author of Carter the Cabman, the book. I have the book here. Carter the Cabman tells the story of a night in the life of a handsome cab driver working in London in the Autumn of Terror of 1888. And Toby is also the founder of the Real Sherlock Holmes Walking Tour of Edinburgh, but now lives, if I'm correct, lives in North Yorkshire with his wife and son. So, welcome, Toby. It's very good to have you here today.
Thank you, Philip. It's great to speak to you. I'm looking forward to discussing all things hansom cab and Victorian with you.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. I mean, I think we can tell our audiences that we met in person already at last year's East End Conference, and I think there was a good, it was good fortune that that you know our paths crossed. So I'm very happy to have you here today.
Yeah, it was a real stroke of good luck, wasn't it? And it shows why these kind of events are so valuable, really.
Absolutely, yeah. So, hello to everyone who was at the conference and who's watching or listening to us right now. Okay, let's talk about, well, we'll talk about the book anyway, Carter the Cabman. And as far as I know, this is your first novel. And maybe we can start with, yeah, you telling us about a bit about yourself and how you came to be a writer and to write this brilliant book.
Yeah, so it is a very long story, but I'll try and boil it down to the essential facts. So really from the time just before I went to university, I knew that I wanted to be a writer, or at least write some stories. And I spent from the age of about 17 the next 25 years trying to write stories. And believe it or not, in that time, a quarter of a century practically, I never actually managed to write a story that I was happy with. A lot of other people I knew in and around university at the time wrote stories, some of them put them out there. But I was just, I don't think it was that I was a perfectionist particularly, but I just never wanted to put anything in the public domain unless I was really happy with it, by which I mean that it was the story that I'd envisaged writing when I first started writing it. And I had a real good go at writing some novels, historical fiction, and a lot of them I got very far into them. I'm talking writing tens of thousands of words before eventually stopping and putting them aside because I realized it wasn't the story I wanted to tell. So it wasn't looking very, very good after 20 odd years of trying to do this. And then back in 2017, I was living in the beautiful city of Edinburgh, which, as you know, is a very literary city. I mean, if you just think off the top of your head, the authors that either were born there or wrote there, it's incredible. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir
Of
Walter Scott, J.K. Rowling, Ian Rankin. You can just go on and on and on. And if you're a aspiring writer, there's no better place to live because if you can't get inspired living in Edinburgh, then you'll never get inspired anywhere. And at the time, I just set up my own historical walking tour company. So my job was taking groups of people around Edinburgh for 2 hours, telling them the incredible true story of how the Sherlock Holmes stories came to be written. And after doing this for a while, I realized that I wanted to have another go writing my own original story. And I decided I wanted to set it in Victorian times, but probably in Victorian London rather than Edinburgh. And at this time, one of my relations, my aunt, was doing research into our family tree. And as normally happens with these things, she dug up all kinds of fascinating stories, but one in particular really stuck in my mind. And she discovered that my great great grandfather was something called a knight soilman
Okay.
in the city of Stoke-on-Trent in England, where I'm from, where my family still live. Do you know what a knight soilman is, Philip?
Yeah, I think I have a rough idea, but maybe you'll explain it to the audiences who don't.
Okay, so a knight soilman, it was a, you know, there's a BBC TV series called The Worst Jobs in History, and it's probably a contender for that. It's basically a knight soilman drove around the city at night time with a horse and cart and cleaned up all the rubbish from the streets, a lot of which was horse manure, and also emptied the communal toilet. Now, a lot of streets, if they were lucky, had a shared toilet for the entire street. So the knight soilman's job was to empty this, put it onto his cart, and take it away. And that's what my great great grandfather did as a job.
Right.
Unfortunately, he met a very tragic end.
Okay.
One day, it was the middle of the night, and his cart turned over. What we think happened is that his horse was spooked by something, probably a nocturnal animal running out in front of the horse. But at that exact point, the horse and cart was on a road that had a steep drop either side. So the horse swerved, the entire cart tipped over and crushed my great-great grandfather to death. So obviously, this story really fixed in my mind, and combined with what I was doing for a job, doing historical walking tours, the two things really came together, and I realized I'd finally stumbled upon something close to the character that I wanted to write about, and the character whose voice was going to tell the stories that I wanted to tell. Now, I didn't want my character to be quite a knight soilman. Something a little bit more romantic than that. And at the same time, I was rereading some of the Sherlock Holmes stories, and there's a wonderful passage in The Hound of the Baskervilles where Holmes and Watson are following a hansom cab down, I think it's Regent Street, and Holmes makes a remark about how the person in the cab is in the power of the hansom cab driver. And suddenly I had my character, and I realized I was going to write a story about a hansom cab driver. And to make it more interesting and more atmospheric, I decided he was going to be working at night in Victorian London. And I had one more decision to make, which was when exactly in Victorian London. Because as you know, the Victorian era was like 1837, is it, to 1901?
Right, yeah.
And so I had a long think, and I decided I've got to find a way of hooking people's interest in my character. So I decided I was going to set it during the Autumn of Terror.
Yeah.
I had this incredible backdrop to the original story I wanted to tell, because really the story is first and foremost a story of the life of my main character. But I thought if I set it during the Autumn of Terror, then you've got this whole other layer and subplot going on, and I can weave the two separate things together. And I thought, you know what, it would also be so interesting to have the Autumn of Terror told through the eyes of an ordinary man who might have worked and lived whilst it was happening. And that's how the book came about.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, I think you really achieved what you wanted to achieve when I read it. And then also, I mean, it is right, just like you said, you can always still you can people hook with putting the Autumn of Terror and Jack the Ripper in there because they're interested in this story and in the period. And then you can write, if you just have this as just one part of your story, it's already something that people find interesting. And I think, yeah, you did a brilliant job in combining all these elements that you wanted to. I mean, you could have put, done or set the whole thing in Edinburgh or wherever, but it's just the right combination of things that you found there, I think. So I really liked it and loved it, and I hope the audiences do too, or have done it. But before we continue talking about the book, I just wanted to ask you, or maybe tell our audiences a bit, because I think that's also a very interesting part of what I know about you, about your Sherlock Holmes walking tour that you did or have done in Edinburgh.
Yeah, well, I am a big Sherlock Holmes fan. And that starts first and foremost for me with the original stories. I lived altogether for 15 years in Scotland, even though I'm from England, I'm English, but I moved up to Scotland in 2003 and lived there until 2018. And obviously, loving the Sherlock Holmes stories, I knew that there was a big Scottish connection. For people who don't know, the author of the stories, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, was born in Edinburgh, so he was Scottish. And the idea for the character came from when he was a medical student at the University of Edinburgh, so he was training to be a doctor. And there were two people who really made a big impression on him. One of his teachers was a professor of medicine, Dr. Joseph Bell, who had incredible powers of observation and deduction. So a patient who he'd never met before could come into his treatment room and within the space of 60 seconds, simply by careful observation and listening carefully, he could deduce all kinds of things about this person's habits, family, personal history, where they were from, if they traveled anywhere, what their profession was. And obviously, that gave Arthur Conan Doyle some of the material he needed for Sherlock Holmes. And there was another character called Sir Henry Littlejohn, who was a police forensic professor and was one of the first people anywhere to bridge the gap between forensic medicine and crime. So he realized that his medical knowledge could be used to help police solve crime. And he was another one of Arthur Conan Doyle's teachers. So these two characters obviously inspired the idea of Sherlock Holmes. And what I used to do, I lived in Edinburgh for 5 years and I set up my own walking tour. And I would take groups of people around the city, showing them as many of the key sites in the city that I could. So the street where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was born, which is where the Edinburgh Sherlock Holmes statue is. The University Medical School where he studied, a house where he lived, where he was a medical student, the building where he first observed Dr. Joseph Bell's method. And I weaved a tour out of this, and yeah, that was my job. That's how I earned my living for several years.
Brilliant, yeah.
And although I don't live in Edinburgh, so it is very difficult to do a tour now. It's never officially closed, that tour. I've not done one for a good while, but even when I moved down to North Yorkshire for the first couple of years of living down here, people would contact me, and if the group was big enough, or they were prepared to pay enough money, I would travel back up and do the odd tour. So it's like a dormant volcano at the moment.
Yeah, I think there'll be some more in the future, in one way
Maybe.
or another.
Yeah, maybe.
I'd like to participate in one, so there has to be one more, at least one more.
Maybe I'll do just an informal one for you.
maybe.
I'll have to dig out my Inverness cape and my deerstalker. Because I used to do the tours in full Sherlock Holmes costume, by the way.
Yeah, I saw the pictures online, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just thinking when you talked about Joseph Bell and Sherlock Holmes, I already had I did an interview once with an American author, Bradley Harper, whom I got to know quite well too. And he wrote a book, it's called A Knife in the Fog. And there he has Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Professor Bell and a lady from London called Margaret Harkness. She was a writer, and she was very much for, she wrote as a under the name of John Law, I think, because it was more difficult to write as a woman during that time. Anyway, he has these three characters investigating the Jack the Ripper murders in the Autumn of Terror. So it's kind of an interesting, very good story. Because it is written from Arthur Conan Doyle's point of view, and it's he's getting inspiration for his stories. That's kind of the background, by seeing how Professor Bell, investigates in the Ripper murder. So that's quite an interesting book. So I mean, there's a lot of connections between Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper.
Oh yeah, it's a fascinating thing, isn't it, that really Arthur Conan Doyle never wrote a Sherlock Holmes story in relation to the Whitechapel murders. It's a real enigma,
Right.
and obviously other authors have then tried to fill the gap by having Holmes investigate the murders, but there's a lot of interesting history there, and it is something I used to touch on in the tour. There is evidence that Bell was invited down to London during the live investigation,
Is there?
and was
I didn't know that. Yeah.
was given access to the case files
Okay.
because his reputation was so strong at that time. And yeah, he apparently did informally name the person who he thought was his prime suspect, but
Okay.
that's never actually been discovered who he thought was likely to be responsible. But yeah, he was involved in some aspects. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's quite interesting and quite instructive that Arthur Conan Doyle did not get himself involved in that when it seems such a ripe opportunity
Yeah,
for a story.
but maybe he avoided it, because everybody was expecting it. Maybe that was the reason why he didn't do that.
Yeah, or maybe he knew something that he didn't want to share. I don't
Just it's a new story. Write it down for later.
know.
Have you been interested in the Whitechapel murders before writing Carter the Cabman, or was this, it's going to be part of the book, so I'll delve into that topic.
There's no doubt that my interest and knowledge of the Whitechapel murders has grown hugely since writing the book, because once I decided that's when the story was going to be set, obviously I had to start doing some research and increasing my knowledge about the time. And I ended up reading far more about the Autumn of Terror and Jack the Ripper than I ever probably would have done if I had not written Carter the Cabman. So there's no doubt that it massively accelerated my interest in the time. But I was always interested in it, but I just had a very, very loose knowledge of what had happened. But yeah, without a doubt, the preparation I had to do for my book really drew me in to everything that was happening. And now, you know, just as an individual, I am very, very interested in the whole thing. But as a writer, I just take the bits that I think are going to be sources of inspiration or useful material, and then I suppose twist or slightly change them for my own purposes. You know, I remember when I sent you the book,
I was
I
just thinking the same thing,
did see you take your ripperologist's hat off, because you know, anyone who's got a purely factual, historical interest in the stories is not going to be able to cope with some of the things that I do, because that's not the point of my stories. You know, it's you know, I wanted to create a historical fantasy, so it takes the bits that are interesting or are useful in the story, and then it takes them somewhere else. So you have to be able to cope with that, and not everyone would be able to.
Oh, I think many people will, but it's, I mean, that's a what's it called in English? Writer's freedom, artistic freedom. So you can,
Creative license.
creative license. So you can do that. But yeah, so I wanted to show this once again into the camera. So this is Carter the Cabman. I will talk about the illustrations in a minute too, but we talked about the book, but I didn't really say what's, I mean, apart from saying one or two things, what the book is about. But I thought maybe I'll just let you, the author, tell our audiences what the book is about without giving away too much. So, what's Carter the Cabman about?
Yeah, so the book is told in the first person. So the main character is Jeremiah Carter, who's a hansom cab driver who works at night. And as I said, it's set primarily during the Autumn of Terror in 1888, when Jack the Ripper, or whoever was responsible for the Whitechapel murders, was at large. And although there is some time slip in the book, and we go back some years in Carter's life and Carter's memories, the bulk of the book is set during one night, telling of Carter's journey, his encounters with the waifs and strays and the good and great of Victorian London society. But as he journeys and meets these different people, he starts to reveal more and more about his own story and his past and what has brought him to the place where we find him in the book. So two stories are being told: the story of his life and the story of the Autumn of Terror. And as the plot unfolds, these two separate narratives slowly intertwine. But at the end, you know, I leave it to the reader to really form an opinion of what the connection, if any, is between the two separate stories.
I remember, I asked you, and I know you haven't, but I asked you when I read it if you had been influenced by From Hell, the comic by Alan Moore, and you said you haven't. But I always felt, because you also included London as a kind of a almost like a character or as a symbol, definitely as a symbol. In a way that I really like, and that I, kind of can relate to from personal experiences and from the literature that I read. So about this. I really like this way of incorporating London as a symbol into the story and the underlying meaning under some.
Well, I mean, there's a just a handful of characters, really, principal characters anyway, in the book, one of which is London.
Yeah, absolutely. But have you been, as a writer, have you been influenced, by other writers, by literature? What have you been influenced by? Was there anything when creating a story or as a writer in general?
I mean, there are definite writers who influence me, or books that have influenced me. So, it wasn't deliberate. And I wouldn't say he's my favorite writer, although he's very high up there. I do absolutely love his works. But I think that the writer, unwittingly, who I'm closest to stylistic wise is Charles Dickens. I do adore some of his books, and A Christmas Carol, for example, is definitely right up there in my favorite stories of all time. But there's other writers in there as well. So yeah, there's probably a little bit of Arthur Conan Doyle in there. But the book that really probably has influenced me more than any other book, and probably any other work of art in any format. I mean, this is something that changed my life when I read it, age 17. I can literally remember reading it and knowing that my life is going to be different after reading it, was The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. Now, obviously, my story is very, very different, because essentially his is set in, or a lot of it's set in, high Victorian society. But it is also obviously a story of, a descent from a position into a darker place. And you also, I don't know, have you read this book?
Oh, yes, I have.
And you also have, the sort of almost the dual personality in there of how Dorian Gray appears to the world, and then his secret life of sin and shame. And there is obviously that aspect with Carter as well, where we're not quite sure which Carter we're dealing with at any one time. We've got the respectable, handsome cab driver, but we've also got this strange character who's on some kind of self-appointed religious mission that we don't quite understand until more information is revealed. And so, yeah, I would say those writers and those books are the ones that have influenced me the most and influenced the book the most.
And I mean the whole kind of split, or not split personality, but two sides of a personality thing. That's a very Victorian thing, isn't it? I mean, there's Oscar Wilde, obviously, but there's also Jekyll and Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Well, I should have mentioned him. I don't know why I didn't mention him, but yeah, I adore his writing, and he was definitely a massive influence as well.
And I mean, you've got that with the Ripper too, right? So people were thinking about who's this character? So, does he have a good side and a bad side? Is he like a well-established gentleman in on during the day and murderous, killer at night? So yeah, that's very, very, very good. Funny thing is, today is Charles Dickens's birthday, so we're talking on Charles Dickens's birthday, and you talked about the A Christmas Carol, obviously. And I know that last December you also published a Christmas story, just like Charles Dickens did. I don't know if you can see that, about Carter, and it's set on Christmas Day of 1888. So, maybe you can say a few sentences about that, and if it's still available, I'm not really sure. Maybe you can tell our audiences. I'm not quite sure.
So obviously this story just came out in December, 2023. It's my first short story that I've published. And basically, when I finished Carter the Cabman, I decided I certainly wasn't done with that character. Having spent the best part of 25, 30 years looking for the character I wanted, I wasn't going to put him aside after one book. I decided I've got my character. I'm now going to use him to tell many, many stories and to build his world and to expand on what I've done and develop a whole universe for this character. But within that, using that universe to tell many of the stories that I would want to tell in any format and explore ideas I wanted to explore. And because of my personal circumstances, becoming a father nearly 3 years ago, I realized that it was going to be extremely difficult to write the next novel in a reasonable amount of time. The first novel took me 4 years to research and write. So that's when I wasn't a father and I was self-employed, so I could pick and choose when I worked. So completely different situation to my situation now. I am going to write two more Carter the Cabman novels. It's a trilogy,
Brilliant,
and I know
brilliant.
what's going to happen in the second and third books, and there are large passages written, but at the moment it's just not achievable to write them. So I decided, well, why don't I have a go at writing a short story, still about Carter, but just a short self-contained story. And I've always wanted to write a story set in and around Christmas. And I thought, you know what? Why don't I write a story set on the first Christmas after the Whitechapel murders? Because I thought, how interesting is that? What would the mood have been like, especially in Whitechapel where these things had happened? Would people be still absolutely haunted by what had happened? And of course, on Christmas Day 1888, there was still no definite sense of closure at that time. Obviously, the Mary Jane Kelly murder had taken place on the 9th of November, but there'd been quite a big gap from the previous one. So I think it's fair to say that there was no sense on Christmas Day 1888 in Whitechapel and the rest of London that they were definitely out of the woods and nothing else would happen. And as you know, Philip, obviously, there are many people that believe that there were murders after that that were committed by the same person. But London was still absolutely under the shadow of what had happened. And I thought, how interesting to try and write a story through Carter's eyes of what Christmas Day would have been like. Were people just going to be in full denial and pretend that none of this was happening, or were they going to be celebrating Christmas in a very low-key manner? And obviously, I could also add more to Carter's story in doing so. So yeah, I really, really loved the challenge of writing a short story because it's such a different discipline to writing a novel. No, you have to lay out the story. And particularly for people who aren't familiar with your character, set up the world and wrap it all up quite quickly and make it as interesting as possible. And it's all got to flow and hang together. And you've only got, 5,000 words to do that. So it was a huge challenge, but one I absolutely loved. And once I'd done it, I decided, you know what? I'm actually going to write 12 or 13 of these, all set at different times, all exploring different ideas, but with the same character and building on his world. And when they're all done, I'm going to publish them as a collection in a book, a little bit like Arthur Conan Doyle publishing collection of short Sherlock Holmes stories. So that's the plan, and God willing, I'll be able to do that.
Very good, very good. Yeah, I was just before our interview today, I was watching a video by Richard Jones, who's a Jack the Ripper expert and a London tour guide. I've also had him on the show about Christmas Day in London in 1888. So that was as a kind of preparation. And I think you captured the mood quite well in the story of what it must have been like. And also, as you said, there were murders after Mary Jane Kelly, and there was one in Poplar, Rose Millet or Millet, just on, I think it was the 20th of December, so just a couple of days, 3 days, 4 days before Christmas. But most people assume that there wasn't a Ripper killing. So still, there was still this kind of shadow hanging over everything on that day.
Do you mind me asking you a question, just as
Please.
we're talking about this? So have you formed an opinion about whether the canonical five are all victims or were all victims of the same killer, whether we call them Jack the Ripper or whoever it was?
Yeah.
First of all, do you think the five were all done by the same personal persons, or do you think not? And then do you think there are others before and after that could have been? I mean, what's your feeling about it?
Yes, I do believe that all of the canonical five were murdered by the same killer. I think also, I mean, because there are doubts about the double event, Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes both being murdered on the same night, and Elizabeth Stride not being mutilated. But I think, I think there was one killer on the loose on that night, and because he couldn't fulfill whatever he wanted to fulfill on Elizabeth Stride, he went in search for another victim, and he found Catherine Eddowes, and killed her. She was found 45 minutes after Elizabeth Stride, so I think there was no coincidence. I do think that all five of them were killed by the same person, and I think you can kind of see it's getting worse and worse, the mutilations, and there's a kind of until the highlight in Miller's Court, if you like. Like it may, of course, it's a terrible highlight, but for the killer, it must have been like, his mission was fulfilled. He couldn't top what he'd done he had done in there, being in a room. He wasn't disturbed. He could fill out his strange, sick, perverse fantasies, and I think. I don't really know why he stopped. Maybe he stopped because we don't know who he was. Maybe he stopped because he knew he couldn't really reach that level again. Maybe his mission was fulfilled, whatever his intention was. But I think, yeah, so I think all five were killed by the same killer.
That's really interesting to hear what you say. I have got a couple of questions then. So the first one relates to Martha Tabram. Big ongoing debate that will probably never go away as to whether she should be included. And then the second question I have is, I don't know if you remember at all, but during the conference, once Donald Rumbelow had given his question and answer session, there were questions after, and this is before I'd actually met you, but I asked a question of Donald, which was, did he think it was possible? Which is something that's always been in my mind, that whoever committed the murders, as you touched on, just had possibly just fulfilled. Served their most fundamental need with the horrific things that were done to the last victim? And was it possible that he just stopped and carried on with his normal life, maybe lived for another 30 or 40 years? I can see a lot of people not comfortable with that idea because it doesn't fit in with everything we think we know about serial killers. But I just think it's something that is never really discussed properly. As I brought up in the conference, there are now concrete examples of people who are serial killers, who did escalate terribly, who committed terrible crimes, and then literally just stopped. So, we have now got precedents for that, and yet it's never discussed with the Ripper. So those two questions, Martha Tabram, and then just the one that I brought up there.
Martha Tabram, as you said, ongoing debate. I do think it's highly possible that she was a victim of the same killer. And maybe he'd had not, well, if she was, it's my theory, and that's all we can do because we can only theorize. We just don't know what happened. My theory is that he had not found his way of killing or his modus operandi yet. And also, I mean, she was stabbed 39 times, so he must have there must have been some, well, aggressiveness definitely, but there must have something else. Maybe he didn't really know how to experience what he wanted to experience, if you like. And maybe he realized while killing her, and then he kind of found his way of mutilating these women when they were dead by the time he killed Polynikos. So he knew what he was going to do, and then it just went on from there. So I think it is highly possible because I mean the area it's just around the it's around the corner of all the other murder sites. It's early August, just a couple of weeks before Polly Nichols was murdered. So I think there is a high possibility. And also, I mean, there's the first case in the Whitechapel murders file is that of Emma Smith. And she was found, or she was attacked by a gang of men. And or that's what she said. And they beat her up, and they put up a some blunt object into her vagina. And she wasn't killed, but she died of the injuries a day later. And she only told the doctor before she died. And everybody says, yeah, I mean, she wasn't killed by the Ripper because she said she was attacked by a group of men. But then again, someone I just read an interview or listened to an interview where someone suggested that she just told the doctor that they were a group of men because she had to tell something, and maybe she knew her, maybe it was one attacker, maybe she knew her attacker, and she didn't want to tell his name, or was afraid of telling who it was, so she just said, yeah, I was attacked by a group of men. And I never thought about that, so I think sometimes you just have these the story is set the way that is that you tell it, or that you just you have it in your mind the way it has been told over the years, and you rarely look to the left and the right, and then sometimes you think, yeah, I mean, that is a possibility. Maybe she was a victim of the same man too. But anyway, let's go to the second part of the question. So yeah, or to the second question, I think there is a possibility of what you just said, that he whatever intention the killer had, whatever he wanted to fulfill or live out, or whatever drove him to do what he did, I think there is the possibility that once he had killed Mary Kelly, he had achieved what he wanted to achieve, and that he just stopped. And he was not arrested, he did not commit suicide, he there all the ongoing theories. Maybe he just stopped, and then, as you say, because there are some cases of serial killers who just stopped and lived on for another 30 or 40 years. So I think there is the possibility, which of course is, well, it is a bit frightening, isn't it? Thinking about it, you know, this guy or this person still being, well, maybe in the middle of it, or at least being alive.
In some ways, it's the most chilling possibility of all, isn't it?
And I mean, well, if you think about the killings that came later, I'm not really sure. Well, after having killed Mary Kelly, I can't really imagine him going out on the street again and you know, killing a woman and then being interrupted by the police and running away. It doesn't really, you know, fit into what, well, I can't really put it into words, but I think you may know what I want to say or what I'm thinking.
It doesn't hang together. It doesn't make sense, does it?
So I do think there's the possibility. I mean, the other thing that I could imagine happened is that after he had killed Mary Kelly, when he maybe was in some kind of normal state, sober state, that he thought, okay, I can't really live with what I did there. You know, it's, I mean, this that you, or maybe your mind can't cope with what you did there. So I think maybe, I don't think he went insane. I don't really think that's what happened, but I could imagine him committing suicide in a sober state of mind, thinking, you know, this is not, I can't live with what I did and what's going to happen next. What am I going to do next? You know, after I did that, I think that's also a possibility, but we don't know. But what's your idea? What's your theory? Do you have one?
Absolutely agree with everything that you've said. If I had to express an opinion, I would say I believe that Martha Tabram was the first king. I believe that it was his first flirtation with what he wanted to do, and obviously, by the standards of the later murders, it was a very unsophisticated killing, execution, if any killing can be sophisticated, but it was just him experiencing what it could be like to snuff out another human being before he, as you said, developed his modus operandi. So I believe that she was the first. I don't have the same level of knowledge that you have, but from what I've read, my gut feeling is the canonical five were all committed by the same person.
It
And
is
I believe,
the feeling, isn't it? It is the gut feeling. That's a very important part for me too. Sorry.
believe it did stop with Mary Jane Kelly. I believe that, his principal subconscious need was not to kill, it was what he did after the killing. And obviously, what he did after he killed Mary Jane Kelly, I mean, it wouldn't actually be possible to destroy or mutilate or investigate a human body more. I mean, there's literally nothing left to do, is there, after that? So I believe either in a moment of, as you said, a sober moment, conscious, he couldn't cope anymore with the knowledge of what he'd done, and he perhaps did end his own life. Or the flip side, somehow could live with what he'd done, but no longer had any needs to fulfill. So I basically agree with everything that you've said, but like you, I'm not saying that my mind can't be changed on any of this.
Mine too. Absolutely. There is an ongoing fascination still about the topic, isn't there? So that's always interesting to find out new aspects or just another point of view that might, change your mind or open up your mind to new ideas.
Can I ask you a couple more questions?
Yes, please, of course.
How is your German book on the Autumn of Terror gone? And have you learned anything new about the Autumn of Terror from your German readers who you've had contact with?
So, first of all, well, thank you for mentioning it. it went very well, thank you. So we're quite happy with how with the feedback that we got, and we know that quite a lot of people are, yeah, a lot of people bought it. So there isn't interest there. I think, I was or we were contacted by a couple of podcasts and radio stations and for interviews, and we did a couple of them, and one was quite interesting. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it because it hasn't been it hasn't been published yet, so maybe I'm on thin ice here. But let's just say the person who did the interview with us was very, or kind of had an agenda, a certain story that, people who are interested in this case, they must be, like, they must be weird. So what's so fascinating about the case? And I'm trying to be vague here because I don't want to hurt someone's feelings or, so yeah, that was kind of interesting because sometimes people they have a prejudice, like dealing with violence or crime or serial killers, that you there must be them they those people must be strange. And what's so interesting about killing women, and why are we still talking about it 130 years later? And I said that it's not about that. It's not about, well, for me, it's not about the violence or, not about killing women. The fascination is because of the period of time, because of the social history, because of you get a real good glimpse into a certain period of time in a very detailed way, about the living conditions, about these women's lives. And of course, because we don't know who the murderer was, there's still this true crime thing, this fascination, this myth, that's covering everything. So of course there's a the story is just so fascinating in itself. Anyway, so there was a bit of interesting feedback that I got, but apart from that, yeah, I what did I learn? Or did I learn something new when writing the book? I think, yeah, what I definitely did learn, because we had to translate a lot, because obviously we had to translate from English into German, and you very quickly see how easy it is to misinterpret certain things. And especially when you think about these, if you then compare certain witness statements, for example, and then you start to translate them, you have not only have three different versions of the same story, but six different versions, and you see how easy it is to get on the wrong track, or and also how easy it is to take things for granted, and then you suddenly realize, hang on, what did Israel Schwartz really see in Berner Street? So, as I said earlier, when you have this Ripper story, that's like a the story is set. You kind of always, or as a tour guide, you always tell it the same way. And then Israel Schwartz saw this, and then Louis Dimschitz came with his wagon, and he found the body of Elizabeth Stride. Or you tell the story of, yeah, George Hutchinson met Mary Kelly at 2 a.m. on the night of her murder on Commercial Street, etc. You always tell these things the same way. You have this story set in your mind, and then you realize, It maybe, obviously it wasn't like that, but there's so many possibilities how all these little details could have been or could be different. So what happened really? You just don't know. So I found that very interesting, because it added to this whole, the only thing that's certain about Jack the Ripper is that nothing is certain. So it added to this. That's not my statement. It's by Richard Jones, but I think it really encapsulates the whole case. And it's part of the fascination, isn't it?
I agree. I mean, I totally agree with what you said. The killings are, of course, interesting in themselves, and however gruesome they are, they are interesting in themselves. And obviously the element of the unknown killer is very interesting, but I think it's the bigger picture
Right.
that
Yeah.
most of us are interested in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
London's social history,
Yeah.
the geographical area, the living conditions, the law, because it's like through this story is like a lens on a much bigger thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to ask you. I did a bit of re of. Of course, I did. I did a bit of research before our interview, and I think you did a kind of publicity stunt before releasing the book, didn't you? In Whitechapel, and
I
the
did.
yeah,
Yeah,
that's about it.
just shamelessly trying to find different ways of getting some interest in my book and getting people to discover my book and try and get a bit of a vibe around my book. So yeah, I traveled down to London shortly after the book, well, a few months after the book had been released. And on the anniversary of the night of one of the killings, I hid five copies of my book in public locations for people to just discover and come across. But you know what the really crazy thing about it was? I mean, I had a fantastic time at it was a Friday. I travelled down, so I'd been working all week. I travelled down on the Friday night straight after work, got to London late, hid five stories in and around Whitechapel or in relevant places, spent the next day just soaking up the atmosphere and enjoying being in Whitechapel, and went home back on the train back up north the following day. Of the five copies that I left, I only ever got news of one being found.
Oh, really?
I to this day, I have no idea who discovered the copies of the book, or if they were just thrown away by people or whatever. I only ever got one message from someone.
What was the message like?
Sorry.
What was the message?
No, so it was just a guy who was down there for the weekend with his son, and they were just sitting on the Saturday enjoying the sunshine in Mitre Square, and noticed the book attached to. They're all in plastic bags in case it was raining, clear plastic bags, and yeah, it was attached to the railings, and yeah, he was delighted to find it. He was actually someone who was already very interested in that time. So yeah, he became a follower and
Great.
really enjoyed the book. But yeah, I mean, sort of effort versus reward. I'm not sure
Oh, you'll never.
if it was worth it. But anyway, I had a good time doing it.
You never know. Maybe in 80 years' time, it will. One of the books will come up in a very strange place. Or
Maybe.
you never know. But it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the one that was found, definitely was found, was the one in Mitre Square, the one in the city. So the
Yeah.
ones in the East End, they are lost.
What I found most strange about the Mitre Square one was, though, I was mooching around late at night in Mitre Square, trying to find a place to leave this odd package. And as you know, Mitre Square is just a stone's throw from some very high-profile buildings like the Gherkin. You can literally see it from the edge of Mitre Square. And it was like, no, and there must be so much CCTV around there, Obviously, in an age where people are always very vigilant about potential terrorism and that kind of thing. And no one ever challenged me. No one came to ask me what I was doing. I mean, this package could have been anything, No one removed it. It was there the following day, hours and hours later, for this man to discover. That blew my mind a little bit.
Yeah, I understand. But did you check where the others, maybe the others are still there?
Yeah, no, I went the following day. I walked around all the sites. One was still there. That was attached to the railings in front of Christchurch, Spitalfields. But I did one. I attached one to, I think it was a window or a window sill, just down the alleyway next to the White Hart
Gunthorpe Street, yeah.
on Gunthorpe Street. That went very quickly. I think that was the first to go. I think I put one outside the Jack the Ripper Museum. That went very quickly. I'm just trying to think where the last one was at. I can't actually remember, but one was there for quite a few hours. But yeah, I never heard anything about them other than the one that I mentioned. So yeah,
Maybe
but it was fun.
sorry.
It was great fun.
Yeah,
Great fun.
it sounds like a good story. Yeah. Who knows where they'll end up? Well, where they ended up and where they were. I wanted to ask you one more thing. Because as I said, the both the book and also the short story, they are brilliantly illustrated by the Italian comic artist. I think it's his name is called Daniele Serra, two-time winner of the British Fantasy Awards for Best Artist, and his work has been included in books by the likes of Stephen King, I read. So, how did you get to know him, and what was working with him like? And obviously, you put a lot of effort into illustrating your work. So, what was the behind that?
I wanted the book that I'd spent so long trying to write, and put so much effort into. I wanted it to be a beautiful thing, a beautiful object. And I knew that I wanted it to have a beautiful cover and to be beautifully illustrated. So when I was getting to the point where I knew I was definitely going to finish this book, I started just looking online, searching for professional illustrators, trying to find people whose work I liked and could imagine illustrating my story. And I found Danny pretty quickly. I think I just found him on Twitter, actually. Contacted him and explained what my book was about and asked if he would be interested. I really didn't think he was going to say yes, just simply because of the people that he's illustrated for. And now I know him a lot better. I truly understand how busy he is. He's just constantly working. He doesn't have to go looking for work anywhere, just constantly working, very prolific. But luckily, he can pick and choose what he does. And luckily, when I explained what the story was about, he was interested. So, I started trying to explain what I imagined the cover to be like, and sending him certain images of London that I wanted to be in the backdrop, but then left it to him. And then when he sent me back the first photograph, the first image of the cover, it just blew me away. It was way beyond anything I'd ever hoped. And I'm very lucky. He gave me the chance. It's a painting, and he gave me the chance to purchase the original painting, and I have it framed on the wall in my study. And it is a work of art. It really is. And then, I asked if he could do some internal illustrations, which he said he could as well. So it was just one of those things where, maybe if I'd gone to him a week before or a week after, he would have been too busy or whatever. But I was lucky. When I contacted him, he had the time and he had the interest in the story. And I just feel totally blessed to, have him as the illustrator, and for him to have done the cover for my short story as well, because, he's brilliant at what he does. He really understands what I'm trying to achieve. He understands the visual language that's needed to complement the stories. He's very interested in that period of time, the kind of atmosphere that I try and create in my stories. And it's a true collaboration. And I'm completely aware of how the visual stuff that he has put together to complement my story, it's had a massive impact in attracting people to my work. I've got no illusions about that. I've spoken to quite a lot of people who said, yeah, I saw the book cover and I thought, what's that? I'm going to buy this book. So it's a huge part of the world that I'm trying to create. And I just hope that he will carry on being able to produce stuff for me, because as long as he's available, he's the person that I want to illustrate my stories.
Yeah, I hope so too, because it really does fit the story and the style of your writing too. So it really encapsulates that. So he has to
Yeah.
be there for the next ones. So
It's very strange. Sorry, just to finish off, it's very strange because I've never met him in
yeah.
person. I've never actually heard his voice. We've never spoken. It's just all been via email or messenger. And when someone, when something's so close to your heart and everything you've ever worked towards, and then there's someone else who has played a massive part in bringing it into realization,
Yeah.
to have not met or have even spoken to them. I mean, that's the age we live in, but I would love to actually meet him one day. Hopefully I will.
Oh, you will. I think so.
Yeah.
So, Toby, we only have a couple of minutes left.
Okay.
Let's just maybe finish this interview off with you briefly telling us what we can expect, when we can expect something new from you, and I wanted to ask you something else, but I forgot. So yeah,
Okay.
and where people can find you and purchase your book and your work.
Well, I'm currently working on the second short story now in the Handsome Times series. So I'm about 40% through. It's going to be all to do with Victorian freak shows, the Elephant Man, the Great Age of Steam, medical experiments. So I'm really enjoying writing that. Hopefully that's going to be out in the next few months in pamphlet form. But yeah, if people want to read my stories, you can search for my name on Amazon Kindle, so Toby Virgo.
I put it down in the
Part of the cab man's there, and My recent short story, All Saints Days, is available as an ebook. If people want the physical copies, then they can buy them from me directly. And the easiest way is to go onto the Car to the Cabman Facebook page and just send me a message and I'll get straight back to you.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And please follow Toby and Carter the Cabman's Facebook page because there's some brilliant stuff there. So thank you very much, Toby. Once again, this is Toby's book, Carter the Cabman by Toby Virgo. As I said, I'm going to put a link to the book and to your Facebook page into the description of the interview. And yeah, thank you for joining me. It was great to have you here today, Toby.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Philip.